Hey everyone, welcome to the Mass Construction Show. I'm your host, Joe Kelly, and this is a podcast about all things construction in Massachusetts and beyond. We are back with Mike Procopio. Typical short episodes on management, leadership, real estate, all the things we love to talk about. I enjoy hearing all the positive feedback about the episodes with Mike. People that might be kind of atypical listeners really enjoy Mike, so everything doesn't have to be for everybody, but I know that there's been real positive feedback that I'm hearing from folks about these short, impactful episodes. Today's show is brought to you by Central, commercial carpenters and supporters of our conversations. Enjoy the show. All right, Michael, we're now in your wheelhouse, multifamily retail. You had a few posts, I won't read them all, but the gist of a couple of them were that expenses are shifting. Maybe where like typical question marks were or typical costs were are changing. You noted insurance being a big one of them. And then you also talked about how in this environment where there's all those risks. Let's start with what are some of the risks from an insurance standpoint that you're seeing these days that you haven't seen in the past?
So it's, in some ways it's super complicated, but insurance used to be a really predictable piece of the pro forma. And for context, insurance costs used to be for like casualty insurance on a building, we would say it was going to cost us $300 per unit per year.
And forgive me, when you say casualty, you're talking like builder's risk?
Insurance, no, beyond builder's risk, once it's stabilized. So builder's risk market's a whole different animal that has ups and downs and can get really bad or be really reasonable, but is generally manageable because it's an upfront capitalized cost. So not that it doesn't matter, but if your builder's risk premium for 2 years to build your building goes from $300,000 to $800,000. That hurts, but that's a one-time cost up front. That doesn't impact your operating cost, which is how the building gets valued.
Okay.
So that's painful, and you got to figure out how to solve it, but it's less impactful than if your casualty insurance, which is like your home insurance, like your fire
forever.
Insurance, it's annual forever. So that comes out of your
profit.
It comes out of your net operating income, which is how you calculate the value of a building. So if that policy doubles, I mean, in one renewal period, you might trim $2 million off the value of your building.
Interesting.
So it's really challenging. That used to be very consistent and very predictable. What has happened is that right now the reinsurance markets, which is the markets by which insurance companies get insurance for their insurance.
Berkshire Hathaway kind of, right?
Even beyond. So there's these reinsurance markets where the insurance companies will go out and insure against their losses. So, and some of them are very, very liquid and very easy. So if you think about auto insurance, it's very easy for an insurance company to write auto insurance policies because the likelihood of everyone getting in a car accident and totaling their car at the same time on the same day is zero. So it spreads their losses out. When you look at casualty insurance, historically, it's been the same way where it's very spread out. Well, what we've seen because of what's been going on in Florida and the Gulf Coast and California with wildfires and Texas with hurricanes and Florida with hurricanes is the reinsurance market has basically evaporated or gone really haywire in terms of what it costs them to reinsure their risk. Because in those cases, what happens is if you're an insurance company writing insurance in Fort Lauderdale, and you have 5,000 policies active in Southern Florida, and there's a Category 5 hurricane, the likelihood is that you are going to have 5,000 claims or 4,000 claims. It's not like auto insurance where you get one claim and you can deal with it. So that chaos has driven costs up exponentially across the board. Is it worse in Florida? Yes, significantly, to the point where it is the constraining factor on whether deals can get done is whether they can get insurance or not. The trickle-down effect is that it's made the insurance crazy for the rest of us too. So we got renewals last year. We had a policy on an asset that was $76,000, I believe, and the renewal came out at $126,000. So just to do quick math on that, That's a $50,000, that's $2 million hit to the that's a $2 million hit to the valuation of the asset. If you just accepted the renewal, now we negotiate the renewal, you have all these levers you can pull. The other thing that's happening is that that renewal that came out also wasn't at full value. So there's always a business decision you can make. You can say, hey, the likelihood of me having a full value loss is pretty low, right? So I'll take that risk, right? Okay, I got insurance for $27 million and my full replacement cost is $29 million. I'll take that risk. Well, the reality is the bank won't let you take that risk. And most loan docs have a covenant in there that says you'll maintain full replacement value or you're in default. So now you've got this trickle-down effect of where you potentially might not be able to get full replacement coverage through no fault of your own, just in the markets. Yep. So you can't get it. And now you're in it. So now, and you've taken a massive hit on the valuation of your building and you're in a default of your loan. So it's creating this whirlwind of just real hardship. Yep. No doubt. Insurance has become very, very challenging. In Florida, so I said that we typically see insurance costs, historically saw them around $300 a unit. That was just even 3 years ago. We used to always write $300 to $350 a unit in our pro forma. That now up here has gotten, you know, basically $750, $800 to $1,000 we use. In Florida, $3,500 to $4,000 per unit per year.
Wow.
Unless you're part of a really significant master insurance program, which is has its own challenges. So it's just, it's become a real challenge. It used to be that taxes were the big unknown because communities, you never knew whether you were going to get assessed at full value or half. Like you just couldn't, you couldn't throw it. It was throw a dart. You didn't know where it was going to land. Now it's read the tea leaves. Now it's become, now insurance is just the elephant in the room trying to figure that out. We have a deal in Florida and it is, look, if we can get insurance for $1,500 or $2,000 a unit, great deal. If it's $4,000 a unit, dead deal. I mean, it's that simple.
Okay. So that's deciding whether that deal happens or not. You talked about trying to create value, and let's be frank, it sounds like you need to be more creative now than you historically.
Much more creative.
Yeah. And you had said some areas where you try to do that is construction management, design, brand and design standards, and property management or operations. Now, I thought aren't you guys getting out of property management?
We going to break news on this show, Joe?
I don't know. I thought that was a discussion we had.
But our original, we've known each other a long time. Our original conversation was a long time ago. So we're back in the property management business.
Okay.
As of November 1st, which was 2 days ago.
Okay, then we broke news.
So we broke like news. Breaking news on Mass Construction Podcast. Yeah. So, I mean, I guess the gist of that was when you have to be creative, you have a limited number of areas where you can really create value within a deal. Because if we're going to be objective, we all like to say we build the best building. We all like to say we build the highest quality. We all like to say that, but the reality is most of what is being built is commodity product. There are different classes. There's A and B. There's, you know, high luxury and
amenities.
There are differences. Yeah. So I don't want to take the incoming over everybody's different. There's nuance and there's differences. But by and large, it's commodity product. And by and large, the resident doesn't care. Broad statement, but broadly accurate. I will stand by that. So then you're saying, well, where can I create value in what I'm building if we're all essentially building the same thing and we're buying the same land and we're kind of all doing the same thing, we're just doing it slightly differently. So there's a couple of four silos that we've identified where you can really create additional value. Number one is control the construction management. If you can build it cheaper, if you can build it quicker, if you can build it more efficiently, you've created value for yourself, for your investors. Design standards.
Before you move on from construction management, because is it that you can actually build it cheaper, or is it that you're basically whatever that cost is what you're paying, and is it like a risk reduction or is it a true?
It's not cost. It's not a risk reduction because we're actually taking on more risk. So we're taking on the GC risk as well. So at a certain size point, you can build it theoretically, let's not talk holdout, you can theoretically build it cheaper because you can control your GCs and you can control your staffing. And if I can...
Theoretically, it could be more expensive.
Though, theoretically, too. It could be more expensive. That's correct. And we've had experiences where it's more, where we're not cheaper than somebody else. In fact, we're in one of those interesting time periods right now where other firms are potentially more desperate if their only line of business is construction management. Mm-hmm. So they are willing to grind harder and push harder and be riskier and potentially get to a better number than my own team can internally because our primary business is not construction management.
Right. So we're looking at these four, whatever you call them, buckets or silos, whatever you're saying, like they're levers. You can play with them. You can choose to do it or not, right? You're just, let's say, these are the spaces where there's options for creating value.
Yeah.
One project, CMing it yourself makes all the sense in the world. Other one is, nope. We're gonna hand it over.
Hand it over. Yeah. And at the time I wrote that post, we weren't doing property management, but I was just identifying it as another vertical that you can create value in.
Okay.
Right. If you look at most of the big successful operators, one thing they do share is that they do self-manage. I think it's been an interesting evolution for us. We came out of a world where we historically managed our own assets since the 60s. Mm-hmm. We got out of that business in 2019, we got out of that business, went strictly third party. And it's very, very challenging to get a third party manager to think like an owner and to take ownership. And the horror stories, and it's not about any particular firm or any, we've dealt with everybody. We have worked with everybody across the board, big projects, little projects. It's very challenging when you are not the owner of the asset. And we've come to the conclusion that for us to preserve the value in the asset and to preserve the NOI and to preserve the ultimate value of the investor's return, the investor's money, we have to take control back of the asset. So we started that on 11-1 actually, and we've launched a new company called Bria. It's strictly a management company. It's wholly owned. It's our people. But our plan is to scale that.
Yeah. I would feel more comfortable investing in that model.
Self-managed. Yeah. It's definitely going to be a game changer. The other thing that we're going to drive is we've noticed, I mean, we're very purposeful about why we do what we do. Our goal is to build meaningful human connections. That's our higher purpose here, right? We're not just to build buildings. We believe that there is a deficiency. We've talked about this before. We believe there's a deficiency in human connections. There's a loneliness epidemic in this country. And it's about lifestyle and how people live and how people work, and they just don't have meaningful connections in their life. We feel strongly about that. And one of the things we want to do with this management company is lean into that from a hospitality perspective, make every interaction akin to an interaction you would have in a boutique hotel. You know, be known as Mr. Kelly, not 701.
Tell me this completely off the subject, but have you guys explored communities or buildings centered around certain lifestyles, or like I can think there's down in this place is called like Serembi, where they have like permaculture and all this, like so people that are have the same, I don't want to say values, but like outlook. Is there ever like thing where you would consider a community that's centered around an idea?
We've looked at that. They tend to be very niche and thus very difficult to capitalize, but there's been some very successful ones, right? The most successful, if you really zoom out and look at it, is golf.
Communities
that are built around golf, right? I mean now that's just become a normal thing, that like we build housing on golf courses. Well, that wasn't always the thing. The golf course used to be the golf course and it had a clubhouse, and now all of a sudden it's a golf course and a clubhouse and 67 $3 million homes around it, right? And they all are around golf, right? The Villages is a great example of that. It's age restricted, you know, there's 100,000 people that live there. Everybody drives golf carts, right? Yep. It's wild. There's a couple of other really interesting ones too. There's now quite a few private airport communities. for people that fly, and the houses back up against like a really nice kind of country club atmosphere, but it's all around people that have a plane. Like, I'm not talking like people that have a pilot that fly their plane, but like people that fly their own plane, right? And they literally can land essentially in their backyard and walk or take their golf cart back
and to nobody's mad about it because they want
nobody's mad about it too. Because everybody there has a plane or a helicopter and flies, right? It's their hobby, it's what they do. So there's a lot of those kind of communities. They can be very challenging to sell the house. I mean, imagine you own a $2 million house on a runway that works for you, but when it comes time to sell the house, I mean, you've got to find the guy, right? The guy that wants that house in that city, in that state, and also has a $2 million aircraft that he wants to park in his backyard.
Yeah.
I recently saw, I'm big into racing, and I saw an interesting community built around cars, and it had like an actual like racing circuit, and like kind of instead of like a golf clubhouse and pro shop, they actually had like a set of like professionally set up garages where people could work on their cars, and like people that are big car enthusiasts and stuff like that, with their, you know, whether it's classic cars or whether it's, you know, 911s or whether it's Lamborghinis and Ferraris or new Corvettes, whatever. It's built around like car enthusiasts. And it's the same kind of thing. It's like this community, there's this central amenity that is like central to what it is that everybody shares, which is the car thing. So I think those can be successful. They're very challenging to execute, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think if you're not at a, who am I to say this, but like if you're not at a super large scale where you're having hundreds of units, if it's a small enough amounts, then there's going to be enough people that it's kind of the whole thing. It's a community of, you see it and it's you, it's a hell yes, I want that. But you see that, that's for me, I'll pay for that.
That's
worth it to me. And I think you get that. And I think there's some interesting opportunities there, but
for sure,
complete tangent. So construction management, property management as a potential value add, risk mitigation, kind of getting to where you need to be to make a project happen. And then you also had design and brand.
So brand and design standards, I don't mean necessarily having to do it in-house. We now do that all in-house, but creating standards so that you're not having to reinvent the wheel on every project. So there are, I actually don't know how many off the top of my head, probably 8 Procopio unit layouts. No more. We give them to an architect. These are our layouts. You have any layout different than this, we've thought about them ad nauseum. We know where the doors go. We know where the beds go. We know where the outlets go. We know where the lights go. We know where the windows go. You know, you got to tinker with it in your design, but this, we don't want to see any. This is the layout that we've approved for. This is the small one bedroom. This is the big one bedroom. This is the side-by-side two bedroom. This is the split two bedroom. We have those. Those are in our standards. No different. So we now have a book that we can give an architect or a partner that's no different than if you were to say, I want to open an AC hotel. And they give you a book. This is what all the millwork looks like. This is the room size. This is the bed you use. This is the mattress you use. This is the sink you use. This is the shower rod you use. This is the safe that goes in the room. This is the carpet pattern you use. This is the light goes outside the door. Everything's standardized.
And that's a cost and an efficiency?
It's design efficiency for sure, because so much time is lost in the back and forth arguing about stuff in the design process. It's cost. It's simplifying buyout.
It's probably going to be ease of maintenance.
Yeah, it's ease of maintenance. You have kind of cross functionality across, right? If you have, I mean, we have how many assets and they all have the same faucet in them.
Yep.
That's a beautiful thing.
Like the maintenance person,
right? Use the same kitchen faucet across all of our projects, right? Same light fixtures, same cans, right? Like, so all of that plays into it. And again, if you're going to take the approach of everything's a snowflake and unique, well, you will have some cool projects. They will be unique. They will take you longer. They will cost you more, and you won't get appreciably more rent for them. That's our point. If you can standardize some of this stuff, you increase that efficiency.
And a higher operating cost.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, because I even think of like you people that manage multiple office buildings, and I just saw somebody the other day. Guy was out there and they had a particular type of bulb that was in a light fixture, and they're like, oh, we don't have that bulb, it's on, I work in that building, we don't have these kind of bulbs. And you know, something simple as that. Whereas if everybody has the same bulbs, everybody has the same faucets, to property manage, is
easy. Design is the same. We've flirted with that a little bit here. At one point we had an interior designer in house that was doing a lot of our interior design work. I still think that like a true design build development shop is probably the most efficient path, where you have in-house architecture. and actually take it soup to nuts, being in control of that entire process generates incredible efficiency. Hmm. Incredible efficiency.
Do you think you'd ever go to that point?
Maybe. And we've toyed with it. We, at one point, we were advertising for a design director because we were going to build that out. And it's there's challenges there because you have to build a team that's capable of doing what you, you know, you can't build a team out that's capable of 50 unit buildings if you're going to build 200 unit buildings, mm-hmm. right? They're different teams.
Yeah.
And the same thing goes, if you've got a team that's really good at building the 300 unit buildings and understands efficiency, I don't really want them designing a 29 unit building.
Yeah. Or a single family.
Right. So it actually, there's some scaling issues there of like, mm-hmm. how do you actually do that when your book of work is as wide as ours is?
Yep.
If we narrowed the book of work and said, listen, we're not going to do single families, we're not going to do condo, we're not going to do boutique multifamily, we're going to build between 180 and 400 multifamily units, single, you know, in podiums and wraps, you probably could build that with one team. You just build one little architecture team.
And then you end up having to feed the beast.
And you got
to
feed the beast, which is a problem with all of those things, right? So
yeah, to your point about, hey, on this one, where it's cheaper for us to go
right.
With the GC. What happens if you get three in a row where it's cheaper to go to GC? Now you've
got a problem. You got a really hungry beast. Around. You have a hungry beast. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And that is the backside of the sword on all of these is you end up making poor or can end up being in a position of making a poor business decision for the sake of feeding the beast. And I could literally have a quote that's $20,000 a unit less from an exterior partner and be torn of whether I give it to my guys because I know I don't want to lay people off or I have to feed the construction beast. Mm-hmm. The same thing with property management to a degree. It's a very fee-dependent business if you're going to run it as a standalone business. Mm-hmm. Our projections are, even with everything that we have in our pipeline, we have $1 billion in the pipeline, thousands of units coming online, that will lose money for 3 years.
Interesting.
Even running it lean, that'll lose money for 3 years. I mean, we know that going into it. So I think those can all create value. They all also have, I mean, a dark side's the wrong word, but they all also have dangers and pitfalls that go with them if someone's not prepared or doesn't have the expertise to really tackle those segments.
Yeah, you're managing a whole nother business.
It's all whole. It's multiple businesses.
Okay. So in the current market between interest rates, generally high construction costs.
Yep.
The insurance items that you're talking about, in that scenario, those are the places where you guys are looking to try and make up that difference.
Yep.
Right. I'm going to try and just roll right into one of the next topics, which was, you know, what's the real situation in multifamily developments? You had a post where you were referencing CoStar, and it said CRE transaction volume deals over 25 million are down 79%. That was fourth quarter of 2021. Smaller deals not doing much better, with the total transaction volume off by 53%. We were just talking a little bit about it with the insurance costs and interest costs and how you're trying to find value in other places. What right now, you know, we all headline read and hear things, and I have my own kind mm-hmm. of theory on multifamily residential and the headwinds that are facing it. What's the reality you're seeing right now in the multifamily residential market?
So multi historically has been the most resilient and remains the most resilient of all of the kind of CRE subsectors. It's generally very, very resilient. What we're seeing right now is challenges primarily related to a almost 600 basis point run in interest rates. So most rates related to multifamily, whether on the construction side or on the perm debt side, are in some way tied to the basically the 10-year treasury. Like, I mean, there's a lot of indexes, SOFR, Prime, FHLB. There's a lot of indexes that lenders will use. But generally, if you want to watch one thing to decide our rates in our world going up or down, you want to watch the 10-year treasury. Most perm debt is tied directly to the 10-year treasury. So that went from literally zero, like point, the decimal points, mm-hmm. to five, right? It's off. It came down like 30 basis points this week. It was like five, it's like 4.6 something. But that's a rate we watch every single day. So That increase in costs has made most deals, and by most deals, I mean 95% of deals, unfinanceable. That is the truth about what's going on in the market right now. There are deals, real estate is a long game, so in terms of even development. So there are deals that we're about to capitalize right now that we've owned for 2 years or 3 years, working on approvals, working on this, working on that. So the way that initial underwriting looked 3 years ago to where it is today, the number of deals that are getting mothballed, 90%, 95%.
Okay. So just to use some non-industry terms for folks that are newer to the market, when you're saying 600 basis points, you're talking about
6%
interest increase. 6%.
So here's how interest rates might be priced. So you might have, they use what's called a spread over an index. So let's just keep it really simple and say that the spread is gonna be 200 basis points or 2%. If you want to think in like consumer terms.
Yep.
A basis point is 1/100th of a percent. So it's a decimal point. 0.01 is 1 basis point. 0.1 is 10 basis points. Yep. So you might get a debt quote. A very standard debt quote might be 200 basis points over the 10-year treasury. So that rate.
So if treasury's
5%. 24 months ago, would have been 2.7%. Today, that rate's 7%. So that spread, that difference, that run, has created a bunch of trickle down issues. So some of those issues are, if you're talking about a new development, you can't get, in order to cover that debt service payment, you can't get the same leverage. You can't get the same amount of debt. So if 2 years ago, we were doing, let's just use very simple numbers, a $100 million deal, and we were going to get 70% debt because rates were so low that the interest payments were manageable and we could do 70% debt. That means we would get $70 million from the bank, $30 million from investors, and build the building. Today, if you were to go do that loan, the bank's going to run the calculation. They'll be like, your interest payment's so high, we're only going to give you 50% debt. Now you got to get 50% from the bank at a higher rate, 50% now at 10% or 9% on a development loan.
Yep.
And the other 50% you got to get from investors. And let's not forget the investor money is like 20% money, plus or minus.
Yep.
So now like there's no juice left in the deal. The deals don't work. We also used to be able to reasonably assume that you could probably do some sort of a, once you built the building, the very fact that you built the building, filled it with people, proved out your pro forma, created some value, and you could typically refinance it and pull some money back off the table to return to investors. In some cases, in some examples of our project, we pulled all the money off the table and gave it back to investors, like, and we're playing with house money moving forward. That's gone. There's no ability to, so kind of like the initial deal you put together is kind of going to be the business plan for the rest of the project. That's probably the biggest elephant in the room is debt proceeds. Now this trickles down into other areas because, so less buildings are going to get built, less deals are going to get done to the tune of like 95% of them are debt.
Yep.
The ones that you're seeing go up right now were capitalized a year ago. So we're out in the capital markets now on deals, and it is brutal.
Yeah. And when you're saying capitalize, you're talking about you have
finding the debt, finding the money to build the deal.
Yeah, you've got the loan.
Yep, getting the loan, and getting the investors.
And you've got a set rate on it.
It's brutal right now.
Yep,
absolutely brutal. I don't care who you are. You could have a huge balance sheet. You could be one of the big groups. You know, it is incredibly challenging to get new deals done. So what that's going to do is going to reduce supply. Demand's going to keep going up. Job markets are good. Net migration in terms of jobs into Massachusetts. Pay is going up because of inflation. All those metrics are good. So your renter base is still going to be there. Your tenant base is still going to be there. They're still going to be able to pay you the $3,000 or $4,000 a month that some of these buildings cost. Mm-hmm. You're not going to have the buildings for them because supply is going to be so pushed down. So from that perspective, it's actually, you could argue it's good for the economics of people that already own
existing.
An asset. Yes,
yep.
Correct. Because 2 years from now, 3 years from now, when there's no new supply, because no projects are starting today, that's going to be material. People aren't going to have, the supply-demand imbalance will be even more significant. if you go into the existing assets, so say, well, okay, that's if you're a developer, those are the challenges, those are the headwinds, primarily around interest rates. You could also argue, before we completely move on from development, construction costs have moderated. They're still outrageously high. I mean, to the tune of 100. I mean, so I'll put real bumpers on it. We built a project that we bought out in the fall of 21. Fall of 21. We bought it out for $235,000 a unit in hard cost, podium, 5/1, urban podium, $235,000. That ran all the way up between then. That was only 2 years ago. 2.5 years ago, that ran all the way up to an average of like 365, 370 a unit. That now has moderated down to the low 300s for podium, but still historically outrageously high.
Yes.
Now you couple that with the higher interest rates, all your costs are exploding. Your construction, your land costs are fixed because sellers aren't going to sell it for nothing. Your hard costs are higher than they've basically ever been, except for the past 12 months, right, when it spiked. Your soft costs are higher because now you've just tripled your interest reserve. And if you had an interest reserve on your project of $2 million, now it's $8 million. Where are you going to find the $8 million? Like, it's got to get in the budget somewhere.
Yeah.
So you now have development performance that just don't work. That's the development side. If you look at the existing side of, I already own an asset, what's the impacts on me? Even if you have, so say you even own an asset with really good debt on it. You own an asset with a 3% fixed rate mortgage, but you want to sell it. There's no debt available at sufficient leverage for a buyer to buy that asset. So you're now trying to sell your building. So you want to get $50 million for your building and you go put it on the market. The buyer pool has been used to being able to get up to 80% debt on that asset and have it cover. They're getting between 50 and 55% right now. So they're in the exact same predicament. Their costs are way greater. It's eating up more of the profit every single month just to service the debt. They can't get investors on board because they need so much of the money. You know, for years, the investors were only putting up 20% of the capital stack. And 80% was coming from the lender. Now the investors are saying, oh, you're going to buy a $50 million building? Good. $25 million comes from the investors, $25 million from the bank. So there's no juice left is the problem. So what that's doing is those buyers are so heavily, the levered buyers, is just driving prices down.
Driving prices down for when you want to sell.
Correct. So if you're in a position, if you're in a position where you have to sell, or maybe you don't have to, but you really want to sell, you are going to see a materially lower price today for that asset because primarily debt proceeds are what are driving the conversation.
So do you think the answer is to hang on and not sell?
So it's a mixed bag. So we're in the middle of selling one asset. We're selling our Ironwood asset. We made the decision that it was the right decision at the time to sell that. And we made the decision on two others that we were out of the market with not to sell them. And we're just going to sit on them and we're going to take back management eventually. And we're going to drive the NOI and we're going to do the hard work to get them where we think they'll be in the best possible shape to put on the market next year. It's so dependent on a moment in time. Even I'll use an example from our Ironwood sale process. We had a couple of buyers throughout that process that fell apart. The first buyer, from the moment they put it under agreement with their letter of intent to the moment the deal fell apart, when they actually had to make the call, the end of their DD period, interest rates had gone up a full percentage point.
And that killed it.
Yeah. I mean, it definitely provided the excuse to kill it. It probably did actually kill it, right? I mean, that's material. Like, their interest cost, if they had penciled out in their pro forma, hey, every single month, this is going to spin off $25,000 to our investment pool, and now suddenly with the new interest rate, it's only going to spin off 10. That's a big difference.
Yeah.
And so it moves that fast, depending on when you lock that rate. So I think there is a lot of activity right now around, and a lot more interest in the assumable mortgages. So the most of the agency loans and the HUD loans are assumable. So there is some kind of market being made for those. If you can buy an asset that has an existing HUD loan on it and assume the loan, the downside is you can't upsize it. So, you know, if it's somebody that put a HUD loan on it 10 years ago, you know, it might be at a great rate,
but
you're also still locking up. It's right. They put it on a value of $10 million. Now the building's worth $30 million.
you still got to make
up. You're not really interested in a $7 million mortgage, even if it's a HUD loan that's assumable. What you really want is a $17 million mortgage, and it becomes challenging. So the other thing that it's causing us to do is, if you're or anybody going for an agency loan, which is what a lot of the permanent loans are, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, HUD, that kind of stuff, they're paying extra up front for prepayment flexibility, because the view, my view included, is that rates will come down. There's a much higher likelihood of them coming down from here than going up substantially from here.
So you said they're doing what because of that?
So they're buying, they're paying more up front, or paying more in their rate to have flexibility on their prepayment. Because most of these are pretty rigid prepayment systems, right? So when they're loaning you the money, they want basically a guarantee that you're going to be able to run the term of that loan out. So they're going to put a prepayment penalty on you.
Got it.
And say, hey, I'm giving you this loan because I want the income stream off of the loan. That is what the next
20 years.
Right. If you come to them after they've just spent, I mean, despite close, it costs $200,000, $300,000 sometimes to close one of these loans. Mm-hmm. And they're saying, we're not going through all this brain damage for you to come to us next year when the Treasury's half of that. And refi, because you can take 2 points off of your rate. We're not interested in that. So if you come to us and want to prepay early, we're going to charge you $1.5 million. Mm. Right? Or whatever it looks like. I mean, there's a bunch of different, there's prepayments are very complicated. There's yield maintenance and defeasance. There's a whole bunch of ways, but I'm just generalizing. That's what they do. So most of the agencies now have a program where you can buy flexibility in the prepayment. So listen, we'll pay you a higher rate, but we need flexibility on the prepayment. So maybe, you know, we have to hold it for 3 years, and in year three we can
refinance.
We can prepay it at a much lower payment penalty. So I mean, there's a lot of things that are happening there.
But it's cost that's coming somewhere.
It's cost that's coming from somewhere. So what we're in the middle of right now is a very significant price discovery period for existing multifamily assets. This is very market driven. Boston is one of the better positioned markets. In my view, Boston remains probably the number one investment market for multifamily right now. Mm. Cap rates, the spread of interest rates and cap rates has not expanded as much in Boston as it has in other areas of the country. So it means actually that more deals can get done here than other areas. The same deal here versus the same deal in Florida and the same deal in Texas, it probably gets done here. And it probably doesn't get done in those two other places with the same economics. And it's created opportunity for a lot of players who were considered fringe is the wrong word, but there's a lot of non-bank lenders that are perfectly legitimate in the bridge loan space.
Like hard money lenders, or
something? So in the small end, it's called hard money. But like, there's a lot of what I would call institutional hard money, which is debt funds.
Yeah.
Which is basically hard money, but it's a debt fund. And they're non-bank lenders, so they have way more flexibility. They're not regulated the same way, so they don't have to comply with some of the same things. It's not that they're shady. They're not at all. They're completely legitimate. But you pay more for the money. What it's done is, as the bank rates have run, their rates have run too, but not as much. So we used to do a lot of bank deals at like 3%. And at the time, the hard money was at like
6.
No, like 12.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Like 11 or 12%.
Yep.
Well, now the bank deal for development is like 9 to 10%. Just local bank.
Yep.
Right? Like, that's just where it is for development deals. I mean, we have one deal right now that's in the high 7s. And the hard money rate is still like 13. So that spread didn't blow out the same way. And what it's created is a lot of opportunity for those guys, because their cost of capital is what it is. They can still make loans there, and they become much closer to a bank. Their execution is much better, much faster.
It's easier.
Bank deal, 2 months, 3 months to close, loads of problems. Non-bank lender, debt funds, close in 3 weeks.
Yep.
Close in 2 weeks. We've called some up and been like, hey, we have a really good opportunity. We absolutely need confidence that we can close in 10 days. Can you do it? Yes. Okay. So it's created a lot of opportunity for them. I think the use of the word distress is probably overused. I don't think there's a ton of distress yet. I do think there will be people forced to exit because they got over their ski tips. I think especially if you look at some of the syndicators in the Sun Belt, these guys were buying, they were using 100% investor money, none of their own money. They were peeling a ton of fees off of it, and they were buying at insane valuations. They're in a real pickle. whether they had bridge debt, whether they had floating rate risk, they're in trouble. And yes, some of them have already started to, some of them are already started to fall. Those dominoes will fall. Those assets will get picked up by kind of more traditional players, mm-hmm. and the game continues. But I do not think we're in a kind of existential crisis for the sector, which some people are talking about. I don't think that's the case. Okay. People have to live someplace, and the supply and demand imbalance is still such, especially here, that you will fill your building with residents.
Not typical for this audience, but with the respect, well, from the perspective of the fact that everybody has, or a lot of people have, a home themselves.
Yep.
What do you think it means for single family? I know you guys do some,
yep,
some of that work. Like, is it the same dynamics where prices are going to come down because it's what people can afford?
So I think it's a little bit different. So the leverage is still there. So the way they determine how to give you a loan for a multifamily building is different than a residence, because the residence is just tied to income. Mm-hmm. The multifamily building is tied to the income of the building. So it clips a lot quicker. You could have a person who makes $1 million a year and just lives in a $500,000 house, right?
Yep.
So they can afford, like the bank will still give them the loan. They'll give them the 80%. They'll give them the 90%, because it's based on their income, not the asset. So I think you still will have X number of people that can afford. I mean, I always say this when we talk about affordability. Mm-hmm. Everything's affordable to somebody.
Yeah.
Right? There's affordable housing. Well, everything's affordable to somebody.
Yeah.
So I think that what we're seeing in the single family space is way lower volume, way lower listings, way lower transactions. So when they say, you know, single family home sales down, you know, 90% from Q4 2021. Yeah, it is based on volume, not price. Yeah. Prices are up. Right, I got more for my house. So we were talking about me selling. I sold my house. We're moving. I sold my house like a month ago. I got more for it than I would have gotten 6 months ago, even though rates are higher, because there's nothing on the market. And when I put it on the market, we priced it aggressively, and it sold the first weekend. I think there's always going to be people in that space. Do I think that it will be easy? No, because the volume will be challenging. That's the thing, right? You're not gonna see churn of like the number of houses selling. Another anecdotal thing that we have a condo deal in Portland. Those 54 condos were like 65% sold out. So thankfully we've paid off the construction loan, but we haven't sold enough to actually start giving the money back to investors yet. Mm-hmm. And we've seen an incredible drop off in sales from when rates went from like 6.5 to 8. Mm-hmm. So it stayed strong from like the, like we didn't see almost any change as rates ran from like 2.5% to 3% to 4% to 5% to 6% to 6.5%. And then like at 6.5%, it like fell off the cliff and people were like, all right, we're not buying. Mm. And it like just totally shut down. Now we're in a good position in that like the debt's been paid off. We have 22 condos there. We know the values there. They're downtown Portland. You know, we might look at like maybe actually refining them to return some money to investors.
Yep.
But we can be patient. Hmm. I think you will have some of those situations where people can't be patient. I wouldn't be nearly as patient if I still had my floating construction loan that was pricing at like almost 11%, eating us alive, right? Like, so luckily, timing-wise, that's gone. But I think you'll see some of that. But I still believe strongly in the single-family ownership market right now. I think it'll perform very, very well. And I think as rates, ironically, the 10-year treasury is also the rate that influences mortgage rates the most. Mm-hmm. And I think as that comes down, in fact, even the past 3 days, it came down 30 basis points. You should see a material drop in rates.
Hmm. Material meaning like a 0.5% or percent. And I know you're only speculating, but I just don't know what you mean when you say meaningful.
Yeah, quarter percent.
Okay.
A third of a percent. I mean, I think that's if you think about it in terms of what people's affordability is, that's what matters. People, right, well, we live in a monthly nut culture.
Yep. Well, that's why
where it's just what's the monthly payment.
Yep.
And I think one of the things that we also might see, and it's come up several times historically and never really taken root. There's a real chance that if rates remain high for long, you could start to see a reversion to like 40 and 45 year mortgages. which would artificially bring the monthly cost down.
Yeah.
Right? But, it would bring the overall, cost up. The overall cost would go way up.
Yeah.
But it would bring, we live in a monthly nut culture, and it would bring that down. And, you know, because it's not graven in stone that a 30-year mortgage is the only thing you can do. It's just traditionally been what works in this country.
Yeah.
Other countries are not like that. I mean, there's countries where, you know, you go to the Cayman Islands, they do 15-year mortgages. That's what they do. Hmm. Nothing else. So like there's everybody looks at it a little bit differently, but I do think you might see if rates start to come down and this is really a moment in time, I don't think anything changes. But I think if we start to see an extended period of time of rates, you know, mortgage rates above a 7, I think you'll start to see some really creative solutions coming out. There's already creative buy down solutions in the market. So you can do like a 3-2-1 buy down is very common, where you can buy down today, you could buy a house and then you could have the seller buy down your rate. And they could buy down the rate 3% in the first year. So theoretically you could go from a 7% to a 4% rate. And then in the second year, it would be a 5% rate. In the third year, it would be a 6% rate. And then
you just pay cash up front?
Yeah, you buy it down cash up front. But what it gets used for, why it's popular right now or becoming popular, is it's like a little bridge. So if you're relatively sophisticated and your view is in 3 years, rates will be lower, that's high likelihood.
Yeah.
Then that's a great deal. Because you're artificially buying it down just on the front end versus a traditional buy down, which is over the whole loan. You can only buy it down like a 0.5%, maybe a percent. And it's incredibly expensive.
Hmm.
But if your thought process is, hey, I want to buy this house today, I'll buy the rate down. I mean, that's pretty impactful. Huh. And we're using that in Portland to like offer people, we'll buy your rate down.
Oh, interesting.
Refi it.
I'd be curious to look at that. Just see what that looks like in reality.
Yeah. Huh. I mean, cut your rate almost in half right today.
Yeah.
You buy from 7.5 down to 4.5.
And what is it? Is it $5,000 on an average home or what?
Like, to pay for it up front. You're paying the full interest up front. You're paying the interest. You're paying all the costs of that up front. So it's the bank's not losing anything. They're just creating a cool structure for you.
Okay.